Welcome to Owning the Future of Healthcare, a podcast from Health Catalyst, your leading provider of data and analytics technology and services to healthcare organizations.
Hey everyone, this is Daniel Litwin, the voice of B2B, and welcome to another podcast episode of Owning the Future of Healthcare, a Health Catalyst podcast. Again, I'm your host, Daniel Litwin, the voice of B2B. Thanks so much for joining us on this episode of Health Catalyst's podcast. We appreciate you listening along to some healthcare industry thought leadership. Today, we're going to be intersecting technology and the world of healthcare, so make sure that you stay for the full conversations. We've got a great thought leader here today to give us his expert insights. Before we jump in, though, I want to make sure that you're heading to our website, healthcatalyst.com. Again, healthcatalyst.com for more information on some of the tech, some of the trends, and the broader thought leadership you're going to hear today. You can find some podcasts, articles, videos, and blogs, and more on our podcast page on our website, or just head to our main website. There's plenty of good stuff there as well. Subscribe to the podcast as well on Apple Podcasts and Spotify for a full catalog of previous conversations and notifications when we drop new ones. All right, folks, it's time for this episode of Owning the Future of Healthcare. So on today's episode of the Health Catalyst podcast, we're getting a lay of the land for AI, for artificial intelligence applications in the healthcare space. This is a growing intersection of cutting-edge technologies and social services over the last several years. AI has been transforming operations, has been transforming access to healthcare, as well as innovations in healthcare. So with our conversation today, what we're wanting to do is better understand how AI is shaping several care issues as well as care solutions in the industry today, and then provide some strategies on how providers can strategize around the technology, especially in a post-COVID environment. So for insights today, we're joined by Dr. Jason Jones. He's Chief Analytics and Data Science Officer at Health Catalyst. Dr. Jones, great to have you on. How are you doing?
Doing really well, Daniel. Thanks. You're really good at this, by the way. So a little intimidated, but thank you.
Oh, no, not at all. If anything, I hope to make this as comfortable as possible for you. So thank you so much for joining us. And again, I'm looking forward to pulling from your insights here, breaking down this intersection of cutting-edge tech and care. So I want to start by highlighting where the conversations around AI and healthcare are landing today. We'll point our attention across the seas to Europe for a second. EIT Health, which is based out of Europe and its think tank, they released a report called Healthcare Workforce and Organizational Transformation with AI. With that report, they focused on why various demographic and structural changes are pushing their universal healthcare systems to rely more on AI. The main thing I want to pull from that is that they cite life expectancy increasing, as well as a limited workforce to respond to this increase in demand, and just because of that increased life expectancy, an increase in care demand, and then, of course, more complex needs for care, all of this pushing their industry to rely more on innovative, cutting-edge tech like AI. So, just at a general level, do you agree with that report's broader assessment for how care is being strained today? What are your thoughts?
I do, and I see a huge opportunity there for AI to help healthcare. And as we think about it, one of the pieces that we try to keep in mind is the quadruple aim, which people will have perhaps heard of from the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, or IHI, where we try to improve population health and overall cost while maximizing both the person, member, patient experience and that of the provider. And AI can really help us bring together all four of those components while not omitting one, because wherever we omit one, right, we deliver great care, and maybe you've experienced this, but my gosh, did you have the worst possible experience from the provider, bad bedside manner, or whatever, or you had a great health experience, but then you got the surprise bill, and that caused yet its own health negative impact for you. So we try to encompass all four aspects. And the great thing about AI that we should probably talk about really early on is when we think about it, we use augmented intelligence, not artificial, and it's purposeful. Because the part that we need to retain, and I think it's highlighted in the article, is what do we want the computer to do for us? And what do we want to retain for ourselves? If we start the discussion that way, we're likely to have a much better outcome than if we just assume, oh, we'll throw a predictive model out there and we'll have a great experience. No, we probably want to think about what we want that model to do for us and how the human beings who will always be involved in health and healthcare, right? No one can tell you what your goals are in life, what health means to you. That's the part that you want to retain. And we need to figure out how do we fit AI in there as a tool that helps do good for you.
Yeah, I think that's a great summary there. Again, like most things in some of our social service industries, like healthcare and education, keeping that end user, either the patient or the student, respectively, at the center of any sort of technological innovation or implementation of new tools is really key in making sure that it's effective and a good use of time, of resources, and actually improves the quality of life of that end user. I want to highlight another aspect of this report, again, the EIT Health Report. It's claiming that AI could help alleviate some workforce shortages as well as speed up clinical research and development in healthcare, and if integrated well, could also significantly cut down on administrative tasks that take up a lot of doctors and nurses' extra time when they should be focusing on patients and on care. So to realize this kind of holistic AI vision in healthcare, what sort of integrations, in your opinion, need to be seen so that AI can actually achieve that kind of transformational effect on care operations that the report claims it could provide?
Absolutely. And we'll start, Daniel, with where you left off, which is let's make sure we're keeping the humans at the center. And in this case, both the human people or patients, as well as the human providers in the space. And one of the areas where we have seen AI help on the provider side is thinking about the electronic health record. And I'm sure you've heard all kinds of complaints from providers who have said, I now spend 80% of my time talking to the computer instead of to my patient, and that just feels wrong. How can we use AI to help the provider feel as though the system has my back? And if we design for that principle and say to ourselves, well, if we're going to be donating all of our data to the computer system, how can we be using the information that we put in there so that it's actually generating direct benefit for me as a provider without having to, sort of hire people to be transcriptionists and the like? So I think that's one area, because there's a lot more information out there now. And frankly, there's just too much for a human being, even the best provider, to be able to consume. So I think we can help there. On the patient side as well, what we're seeing, or the person and patient side, is the ability to offload some of the simple questions and tasks that people have. I'm sure that may surprise you how many actual providers use Google to help them make clinical decisions. And many of the rest of us can use Google for those same types of purposes. But increasingly, we're finding that for simple types of problems, the poster child here is a urinary tract infection. Most of the time, for a simple urinary tract infection, and we can help figure out what's simple and not simple, can we use a computer to help us get the treatment that we need faster and cheaper and without even needing to take the 20 to 40 minutes of a provider's time in order to do that? And we're seeing increasingly these kinds of use cases, which ends up being better on the provider side. They get to focus on the sort of the more challenging issues, and it helps on the patient and caregiver side where they're getting the types of support that they need. So I think many of these kind of triage and simple conditions, we can leverage AI to really help us.
I also want to turn our attention to some recent high-profile movement by AI healthcare players. One of the big ones that we actually saw in recent weeks was the Microsoft acquisition of Nuance Communications, which is an AI and conversational intelligence platform specifically tailored to healthcare operations. So if we continue to see companies like Microsoft, these big tech players, and really just any of the sort of largest multinationals in our economy continue to expand into healthcare or wanting to sort of add that to their repertoire, What would you say that this signals about future applications or investments around AI? Do you think this is going to be a significant portion of the money or the innovative force that pushes AI into healthcare? Do you think this is just sort of a tangential aside to the broader push in the industry? What are your thoughts?
Well, first, I think for better and probably mostly worse, in the United States, healthcare accounts for almost 20% of the gross domestic product at this point. So we should not be surprised that everyone is going to pay attention to healthcare as a possible growth opportunity simply because it's so large. Microsoft in particular has had a fairly longstanding interest in healthcare. We probably don't want to forget about Health Vault and a couple of other initiatives that Microsoft has had. Nuance is an interesting one because they already had Cortana. And so in some sense, this kind of highlights the differences, as you mentioned, between healthcare-specific natural language processing and generation and what it is that we might expect or experience with a general technology. I've seen Nuance work really, really well for providers, and I'm hopeful that with Microsoft, it can only get better. I've seen lots of providers really gravitate to that as a way to facilitate the seemingly ever extending documentation that they need to do. So I'm really hopeful that this will help us going forward, and we'll have to see what Microsoft does with it. I'm curious.
As am I. Might make for a whole follow-up episode here next time on the podcast. All right, let's go ahead and get a little more granular now. I feel like we've set up some good context for where AI is intersecting sort of, I guess, in more timely fashion across the healthcare industry. Now what I want to do is chat with you a little bit more about some of the specific use cases that you see, some challenges, potential opportunities there, and then strategies for how can we actually realize getting AI at scale in care operations. So let's start with where we don't see AI in healthcare yet. What are some of the unrealized opportunities in AI in healthcare today that you see, and maybe give us a why they haven't been fully maximized yet either?
Sure. I think there have been two ways that AI has sort of not yet reached its potential in healthcare. One is whenever you mention healthcare and AI in the same sentence, people immediately gravitate to what we think of as transactional predictive models. Who's going to get readmitted to the hospital? Who's willing to quit smoking? Something like that, kind of one person at a time types of decisions. So transactional type decisions, predictive and prescriptive modeling are terms that most people are familiar with. And so a piece of it is how do we maximize the utility of those transactional predictions? And the piece that I think has been missing most is that there are very few decisions that happen in health and healthcare that do not involve change, right? And if you don't have change management in your design principles, then what happens is you build a technically terrific predictive or prescriptive model, and it doesn't get used. And you wonder why. And it's because you didn't consider the change management aspects. So in that space of those sort of one person at a time predictive and prescriptive models, where AI and healthcare tend to be most strongly linked, we need to spend a lot more time thinking through the change management aspect. And on a person level, I think most people understand that, you know, there are a lot more treadmills that get bought than get used. Sometimes people, I heard someone tell me once that a treadmill is like buying another place to hang your clothes. So,
a drying rack, right?
That's it. That was the term. That's it. And somehow that wasn't the purpose, but that's what it ends up getting used for. And we see a lot of the same with predictive models. So we've spent a lot of time focusing on the change management aspect to ensure that when we have a technically proficient model, that it will actually be used and solve the problems that we hope. So that's one thing. That's making the use of AI more effective and deliver what we really designed it to deliver. But the other aspect is, why are we only focused on transactional predictive models? Mm. Right? What about all of the other analytic tasks that we have? How are we helping not just the individual emergency room physician figure out whether or not to admit this patient in front of her or him, But how are we doing overall with emergency room admissions? How are we preventing people from showing up in the emergency room in the first place? Do we need to shift our entire focus or resource allocation or even accountability goals in the healthcare system? And we've seen historically very little use of AI to help us ask and answer those kinds of questions. And that's how we think we're going to be able to move to the kinds of systemic changes that you mentioned out of the EIT article. The EIT article also focused on the transactional uses of AI, but somehow we have to approach it as a system. We're not going to reduce that 18 to 20% of GDP problem one patient at a time. We also need to figure out, where do we focus? How do we allocate resources? How do we set and achieve accountability targets? And that's, I think, where we have the ability not just to perfect the use of AI where we see it today, but how we actually alter where we use AI in health and healthcare going forward. And that's actually what I'm most excited about. How do we solve some of the larger issues around inequity in health and healthcare that we've seen lately? That's, I think, where if we're purposeful and really understand what we want the computer and the algorithms to do with us, we can make massive changes at scale.
You're giving me a lot to follow up with you on. You're making my job exciting, but also tough here. So let's expand. No, this is a good problem to have. Let me expand on a few points. So you mentioned first that we need to look at AI beyond just transactional AI and view it as a tool that could restructure entire operations in healthcare. Can you give us some examples of what that would actually look like in practice, specifically around, maybe giving more visibility to the process, helping healthcare leadership and administration better manage, several hospital campuses, for example? Maybe give us some intersections as well as to how it could create more proactive treatment options as well that, like you said, keep people from even needing the care in the first place. Break down just your general vision for how this extends beyond just transactional approaches.
Sure. Do you mind if we zoom out just a little bit more and give you a couple other specific examples?
Please do.
So you like Europe. So we'll go to the World Economic Forum report of tipping points expected by 2025. And I'll give you a couple examples. So these are technological tipping points. So surveyed a couple hundred people, leaders throughout the world, and ask them, what do you expect might happen by 2025? Number one on the list, 10% of people wearing clothes connected to the internet. 92%, 91% of people, leaders, thought that that would be a thing. The first fully robotic pharmacist in the United States, 87% of people thought that might be a thing. There's only one thing on that entire list that had a less than 50% likelihood of happening. Any idea what that might be?
Oh boy, I'm afraid to toss out an example. It might be too revealing.
Okay, I'll spare you. Don't worry.
Yes, thank you. So, I'm curious what that might be.
The only thing on the list, and there were 25, I think, different things on the list, including the internet, clothing, and the robotic pharmacist. The only thing on the, oh, by the way, that included the first transplant of a 3D printed liver. Ooh. 76% of people thought that could be a thing.
I do not want to be the guinea pig for that one.
No.
Let someone else try that out first.
Unless you really need a liver.
Yeah, exactly. Then maybe I'll reconsider.
So the only thing at less than 50% was the first AI on a corporate board of directors.
Oh, wow.
And it was 45%. And we think about that for a minute. What does that mean? And I think part of what that tells us goes back to who was asked the question. And who was asked the question were world leaders, people who might be on boards of directors, right, and thinking to themselves, yeah, I don't need AI. There's nothing, I make perfect decisions. I don't need help. And I think that that is one of the barriers that, interestingly enough, of all things, COVID has helped us be able to get beyond. And I'll give you now two specific examples where I've seen this be the case to try to ground it a little bit. So example one is we have now seen clients come to us, the same clients who would ask us for a predictive model for who might be readmitted or who might show up in the emergency department within the next 3 months or something like that, or who might have challenges paying their bills and might benefit from being connected to alternate payment options or something like that. So these are all those kinds of transactional decisions that we've been asked to help with for decades. and it's important work. I don't want to minimize that work at all. It's really important. We can do a lot of good. But those same clients have now started to ask us, how should we select and then set executive compensation targets using algorithms? And we use the same toolbox to help them understand where they have the greatest variation, what the nature of that variation looks like, where their greatest opportunity is from what counts as excellent performance, and then going a step beyond it and helping them to understand how much of a shift would they have to be able to achieve in order to be on the path that they hope to pursue. And we can use math and computers to help us there, just as we can use math and computers to help us figure out which of the two patients walking out of my hospital today are at greatest risk for readmission and therefore would benefit from some type of differential outreach. So that's thing one. And that's been wonderful to see. Thing two, which COVID also, I think, highlighted as well as other recent social events in the US especially, are around disparities. And the shift that we have started to see is that people have realized that health disparities are real and present. And COVID just shone a huge spotlight on the magnitude of the problem and how dire the consequences can be. It's not as though it's a new thing, but it really shone a light in a new way for us. And now, the same algorithms, imagine I'm trying to predict two patients, they're leaving the hospital. Which one has the highest risk of readmission? I actually feel good about a predictive model that says, oh, the patient on the left, that patient was put on steroids during their hospitalization and they're type 1 diabetic. Therefore, when they exit, they may have an issue figuring out how to retitrate their insulin because steroids and insulin interact with each other. So we need to pay special attention to the person on the left. The person on the right wasn't diabetic, isn't taking insulin, was in for the same condition, but they're not going to have as much trouble figuring out their medication. So we feel good about that, right? The person on the left, we should pay more attention to. How would we feel about that same model who said, oh, that person on the left, that person doesn't speak English as their primary spoken language. We need to be more concerned about them. Yeah, don't feel so good about that. So when we apply our predictive modeling techniques, which we always do in the clinical sense, we look at the clinical context of the individual, and we feel good if we can deliver high quality predictive models around a clinical context. When we apply those same tools and find out that a personal characteristic like age or sex or primary spoken language or race or religion or something else is impacting risk for a bad event, there's a sense in which we feel not good about that. But if we think about this as augmented intelligence, we now also have the opportunity to say, oh, but now we know where to focus, right? Before, I didn't know which types of patients may be experiencing these disparities. But now by using these same AI tools, though I don't feel good about it, the reality is I didn't feel good about the diabetic patient being readmitted either. I just felt okay because it was medical. But now these same AI techniques can help us understand, gosh, we really have a problem with non-primary English speakers in our community. And we need to figure out how we do something about that now. And the same AI techniques can then help us monitor change over time. Are we improving with that population, improving their outcomes? So again, so critical if we apply AI from a leadership perspective to really help us understand where our opportunities for improvement are, and then to couple that with the part that we want to retain as human beings. What are our values? Where are we willing to put resources? How long are we willing to see a change to happen? Who else do we outreach to try to figure out how to solve these problems, right? Those should be the human elements. And then the computer is there to help us understand whether we have more of a problem with age or primary spoken language or race or food insecurity or whatever it is. But let's use the computer to help us understand where those problems are so that we can address them and focus upon them and improve them over time.
I love that intersection of social issues as well as socioeconomic status into care because, I think COVID, like you mentioned, revealed a lot of those inequities. And I think at a broader level also just revealed how intersected everything is. How one lever of power or one lever of, injustice is kind of being pulled by 10 other ones, or when it gets pulled, another 10 get pulled consequently. So, to your point, I think fostering both through tools and also through broader professional education around how to intersect those things and those metrics in a way that is actually useful and equitable would be beneficial. So to that point, I've got two follow-ups here. Firstly, around the equity of the AI as a solution in order to promote equity, right? It's almost like a double layer of equity challenges. We've seen in the past AI being deployed at scale and then being revealed that, the programming that was done was, either intentionally or accidentally racially insensitive, or even more specifically racist. That has come through in hiring AI for several companies, several large companies as well, where, we just see the tool being built in a way that doesn't factor in or doesn't consider how it affects people that aren't white, basically, right? And I'm not saying that is every AI deployment, but I think it's important to think about, especially if the AI is used to solve issues around equity. What are your thoughts around how to build the AI solution in a way that analyzes the field, makes sure that the solution is equitable on along those extra sort of demographic lines like race, sex, age, socioeconomic status, right? But then, not only does it do the legwork there, but then also can tie that into equitable change to the healthcare system as well. How do you balance those two, and how do you actually build a solution that takes that into account? What are your thoughts?
Daniel, I love the way you set up the question because you talked about layers. And the first thing is recognizing that there even are layers. And we think specifically as it relates to AI and health equity, of there being kind of three layers that are not mutually exclusive, but we need to keep distinct from an aspirational context. So layer one is what you mentioned. There has been a lot of harm done through, let's assume, positive intent, inadvertent bias, often in the data that we use to train our models. And we need to make sure that we are not making disparities worse with our AI. And some of the examples that have come out about that, I'll give you one that not everyone thinks about. One of the best predictors of future utilization, which is often seen as a proxy to being vulnerable as a member or person or patient. So if you show up in the emergency department six times in the next month, this is probably not a good thing for you. You probably are vulnerable. But the thing is that the best predictor of future utilization is past utilization. And if we look at past utilization, often what we see is that there have been significant access to care issues. And if you can't access the care, you can't utilize the care, which means we don't think you're going to be vulnerable, which means we don't reach out to you. And then by the time we finally do reach out to you, it's catastrophic and there's nothing we can do anymore. So that's a kind of, it's not an AI issue per se, it's that the AI is being trained on biased data. Right. And so level one is let's make sure we're not exacerbating problems that we've seen. Level two is for those transactional decisions that we've been talking about, how do we want to think about personal characteristics that we do not wish people to change or frankly they can't change? You know, you cannot change your race. You cannot change your primary spoken language and the like. How do we think about incorporating those elements? And there's debate on this. Should we include these characteristics in the model so that it helps us close that gap on purpose? Or should we exclude them because then somehow we're being less biased? I think the pendulum is swinging towards let's include these elements so that we can identify and address them on an individual transactional basis. So that's level two. So level one, let's not make the situation worse. Level two, in the transactional space, let's think about how it is that we use these things on purpose and not just by accident to proactively do good. And then level three is, how do we identify systemic bias and inequity and address those? And that's no longer at an individual who should get a care management call or something else. Now we're talking about where do we focus the overall assets of an organization? How do we design fairly large partnerships between healthcare systems and community systems to be able to achieve a very different level of health than we might have imagined before? So again, I love the way you set it up as layers, because those really are different layers that we can aspire to. And we may not be able to address all three all at once, but knowing where we are in that cake is really helpful for being able to set reasonable aspirations, expectations, and then making progress towards them.
Definitely. And I think almost inversely, the structural issues can sometimes be easier to identify. I mean, okay, this is super anecdotal and maybe just my opinion, but I think the structural issues sometimes can be easier to identify than the minutia of, is the data that I'm using already biased upon input, right? Because I think a lot of, a lot of that work is so granular that there's an expectation that, you know, the professionals that are doing this are doing so with positive intent and are doing so to the best of their ability that, you know, oh, of course not, we're not going to make this data, you know, racially insensitive. And then alas, it still manifests that way. And so I think having more focus on that initial step of, as we're compiling this data and feeding it into the AI, how do we make sure that it captures all of these demographics in a sensitive, equitable way that's actually useful? So yeah, those layers are important. And then last question I've got for you, just to tie everything back around to that EIT report. You mentioned, again, that COVID revealed a lot of inequities, and a lot of the changes that we need to see to make AI work at scale also need to happen at a structural level. And obviously, what's curious about the European model is that basically every developed country in that nation runs off of a universal healthcare system, nationalized healthcare system. In the US, we don't have that. We have Medicare and Medicaid, which is run through the federal government, but for the most part, it's a for-profit privatized system. So I'm curious if you think that has any impact, either or, on the ability to make those large, you know, shifting the ship at sea movements to our infrastructure, especially when it comes to integrating AI at scale. What are your thoughts on how those larger, business models for how we structure our healthcare system guide how we get AI deployed and its impact?
Yeah, that's a great question. So one thing is Medicaid, although you're right, there's the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid. Medicaid is actually administered at a state level.
Right.
So it's different within each state, which can be challenging for organizations that operate across states. But so I'm an optimist here. Were I a pessimist, I think I would say, well, healthcare in the United States is fractured and therefore doomed, and we, you know, that's it, game over. So I try to find the positives in this. So here are a couple positives that I see, not necessarily in the fracturing per se, but actually how it is that Medicare and Medicaid have actually helped inform the commercial sector. We usually think about the far too many measures that we have in healthcare as being barriers. I actually look at them as an opportunity. When Medicare puts out a standard of what would be reimbursed for a readmission and how to count it, what that has actually helped us with, even on the commercial side, because clinicians don't treat Medicare patients versus commercial patients versus Medicaid, they treat patients. So what that act, where I have seen that, believe it or not, actually help us is when Medicare steps in and says, here's how it's going to work, commercial does tend to follow. And what it resolves, interestingly enough, on the provider side often is debates around what counts as a readmission, which you may think is kind of silly. I mean, geez, I got discharged from the hospital and I got readmitted. There are 30 different technical ways that you could actually define those concepts of being discharged and being readmitted. I know it probably seems insane, but I have been in those discussions where for 55 minutes out of an hour, we disagree over whether or not a patient was really readmitted or whether or not they really had a retained foreign object after a surgery or some other thing, pick your med, whether their blood pressure is really in control or not in control, whatever it is. We disagree about the measurement instead of fixing the problem. And I think the barrier that we've seen of over-measurement, we can turn into an opportunity for how we just accept the definition and then figure out how to solve it. And by the way, we can then use those same definitions to help us figure out, for instance, where do we have our greatest inequities? Is it in blood pressure control or is it in readmission? If it's in readmission, what type of patients and things like that? So I think it's true that in the US, our system is fairly fractured, but I don't think that that needs to be an unsolvable barrier for us. I think we can find ways to, if not get past those fractures, at least leverage each of the different elements to their greatest use. And I've seen this play out. So it's not just a pipe dream. We actually can do this. We can figure out how to treat people in the best way possible, how to achieve that quadruple aim. That's shared. Whatever part of the ecosystem you come from, including the members and patients who come to the care system for help. So I would love to see us be less fractured. I don't want us to get stuck on that.
And I think to your point, it's all about layers, right? If there's going to be work sort of at the broader structural level, that needs to be happened concurrently with smaller, more interpersonal changes, motivators for getting individual physicians and nurses to understand and use AI at scale. And then also, like you said, making sure the data is clean, making sure that it's rolled out effectively to all parties. That needs to be happening at the same time as conversations about how do our structures encourage or limit the rollout of technologies like these. So again, Dr. Jason
it
Jones.
Is, but yeah. Oh, where do we want to go?
Right.
What are we trying to achieve? And for AI, what do we want? Which parts of that journey do we want AI to help us with? And if we start there, then we have our onion, but we know how to turn it into something positive and not just something that makes you cry.
Right. Something caramelized and delicious.
There you go.
I got it. Exactly. All right. Dr. Jason Jones, Chief Analytics and Data Science Officer at Health Catalyst. Thank you so much for this conversation. It's been really engaging. I've enjoyed breaking down the push for AI across the healthcare space. And I think we're going to need to do a follow-up conversation here, unpacking some more strategies for implementation. But till then, again, we've been chatting with Dr. Jason Jones, Chief Analytics and Data Science Officer at Health Catalyst. Dr. Jones, if folks want to find out more about some of the work that you're doing at Health Catalyst or how Health Catalyst is a part of this push for AI, how can they learn more or get in touch?
Certainly you can go to healthcatalyst.com, as you mentioned, or healthcare.ai, either place. Absolutely. Thank you, Daniel.
Perfect. Yes, thanks. Same to you. And thank you, everyone, for watching this episode of Owning the Future of Healthcare, a Health Catalyst podcast. If you like what you heard and want to listen to previous episodes or prepare for some upcoming thought leadership conversations, make sure that you're heading to our website, healthcatalyst.com, and subscribing to Owning the Future of Healthcare on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. I'm your host, Daniel Litwin, the voice of B2B, and we'll catch you next time on the podcast.